Hi, this is Chuck Knoll. Welcome to another episode of Getting Your Dough to Rise, the ninth show in this, the last year of the decade. Hey, summer's finally here. It was 70 degrees at midnight last night on my back porch, and 113 degrees in L.A. yesterday. Wait, that's more like hell. The Seattle Storm won every game in the playoffs. The Seahawks are holding serve or winning at home, and the recession has been officially over for 15 months. Imagine that. Okay, that's a hard one to imagine, but I'm not sure how you're doing in these times, but I think a lot of people still feel a little bit recessionary, especially in their home prices. Maybe we have some problem with the term officially. Enough of that. Today we're going to be talking about three different areas. We're going to talk about gold and silver, we're going to talk about charity, and we're going to talk about fixed income. First off, let me just mention that I have George Marley here in the studio with me, and George is the owner of the Coin Market LLC in Lynnwood. And George, I think probably you should change the name of your shop to the Gold Market. Do you see anybody come in with coins anymore, unless they're gold coins?
Oh, yeah. We still see coins. I mean, we're primarily a coin shop, but we're buying and selling silver also, obviously.
Right. But I would think that the play today pretty much is in gold with the amount of attention it's getting in the press.
There's a goodly amount of business both ways, buying and selling, sure.
Well, we're gonna get back with George later in the program, and also in the middle of the show, we'll be talking with Tony Baruffi, who is certified financial analyst and portfolio manager at Seattle Northwest Asset Management in Seattle. But first off, and before we get to Mr. Switzer, let me mention that anyone that has a question having to do with philanthropy and charity, please give us a call during this segment at 425-303-9070. So, first off, Tripp Switzer, president of the Northwest Development Officers Association and senior director of regional development for Conservation International. And thank you for coming to the studio, Tripp.
Thanks for having me, Chuck.
And let me ask you, first of all, before we get into the NDOA, or the Northwest Development Officers Association, why not a few words about your own charity?
Certainly. Conservation International is a 23-year-young organization, U.S.-based organization working on international conservation. Essentially, we empower societies around the world in more than 40 countries to sustainably and responsibly care for nature for the well-being of humanity. Our strategies are multifold. We work at the policy level. We work at the government level on international, regional, and local level. And we work all the way down to the ground. We have a motto of head in the sky, because that's where we need to enact laws and policies that help us conserve nature, and all the way down to feet in the mud. So head in the sky, feet in the mud is how to remember us. And you can check out more at www.conservation.org.
Now, with all the conservation charities out there, do you find yourself mainly in a competitive position with them, or do you have an alliance with them? Do they get in the way of your program, or how does that work?
On the international scene, in terms of the projects we work on, we have numerous collaborative relationships. And it's a great question. Some of our core donors ask that question a lot, both of ourselves and some of the other major international environmental non-government organizations, or NGOs. So absolutely, we work collaboratively, both on marine protected work and terrestrial work. And we do our best to minimize overlap. That's not good for anybody. We want to make sure that we spread our essentially pretty thin resources when compared to the amount of work we have to do out there, as far and wide as we possibly can. For the dollars out there, there's no question we're in competition. We're essentially in competition for a limited amount of philanthropic dollars across all sectors. So friendly competition, if you will, but certainly what we do internationally, we can't afford the competition. We need to be collaborative in attacking the issues that we have at hand.
Now, I was mentioning a bit in maybe a bit of a joking term about the fact that the recession was over 15 months ago. However, ironically, two of the three sectors that we're talking about today, there was no recession or fixed income. Everybody is clamoring for fixed income in these days as a safe haven, and obviously everybody likes gold. So no recession there, but charitable giving, I would think there's been a bit of a recession in charitable giving. Have you noticed that either at your own charity or at the NDOA?
No question, we're feeling it. Through my association with the Northwest Development Officers Association, where I have the privilege of serving as president this year, we call it NDOA for short, and development, a kind of term that those outside the field might not know of. Essentially, development is a term interchangeable with fundraising, but we stress the development of the relationships of the organizations and the people that give to our organization, to give to our nonprofits. In terms of the recession, absolutely. 2 years ago, I think it was about this time, 2 years ago, when things came, we saw the fall of the House of Lehman, and we saw a lot of things hitting pretty hard. And people went into a real entrenchment mode, got down in and really held on, just waiting to see. And I think people are very much still in a wait-to-see attitude. I would say within the nonprofit sector, people have just as much commitment and passion for the organizations that are core, but they might not, in their giving patterns, they might have shrunk their giving. So say you might, in your household, give to 10 different nonprofits. It might have shrunk to about 4. So the real work of good organizations was to hold on to those people who are core to your organization, who the donors that were key to your organization, and for whom you as an organization were top of their list. And I think that's what we're finding, is people aren't really reaching out to support new nonprofits, but really getting back in and really focusing their attention on their priorities. So it's kind of like two steps forward, one step back, two steps forward, one step back, we're seeing in the philanthropic sector.
How about from year to year? I mean, 2008, not a good year. 2009, not a good year. 2010, has it been an improvement over 2009?
Overall, 2010, giving shrunk just about 3 to 4%. So that was 2009 to from 2009 2010.
So we're still having a recession.
We're still having it now. When you look at overall portfolios and how they were down, I think we're still beating the market, if you will, by being able to hold steady with philanthropic giving across national nonprofits. But that's again, people. It runs. Those are general terms across more than a million and a half nonprofits in this country. So here in the Northwest, I like to think we're in terms of what we do and the groups that are involved with NDOA, we've more than beat the market. Again, that's optimism. We're all optimists out there in the fundraising field, but we've done pretty well.
Well, another thing that kind of triggered something that I talked about in the past when we talk about philanthropy, and that is you mentioned that the givers have changed from giving to 10 charities down to 4. Isn't it better for the charities concerned to get larger contributions maybe every 2 or 3 years? And this way, in other words, the giver, instead of giving $25 contributions to 8 charities or whatever the total is that they're doing, maybe they should give $100 or $200 contributions, the same amount of total contributions, but bigger amounts to the single charities, because the administrative costs of the processing of the checks and everything is a fair amount of cost to the charity.
Sure. And so if that behavior we've seen a lot throughout the past 2 years, people shrinking from X number of nonprofits they support to X over 2, they've divided their support. And what they've done is, again, more as a reaction to the recession, focused more a higher level of giving on fewer nonprofits as opposed to spreading it out. But that, and although those nonprofits on the fringe might not like, obviously don't like receiving less support, those smaller gifts at a certain range, let's just pick $25 or below, and I'm not saying those all make a difference, but there are greater administration fees across smaller gifts, and the cost, the return of that, whether it's the cost of mailing a thank you, the cost of keeping someone maintained on a list. What most many nonprofits want, certainly, is someone to make an initial gift at any level and then invest larger amounts and be committed throughout their lifetime. So if donors make a decision to sort of keep that giving, if they're only going to give a certain amount and say it's $25 or less, I'm just picking that as an amount, and they're never going to move up from that, it almost is better for a nonprofit, if you will, to have that giving be directed into a larger larger amount to one or several or just fewer nonprofits.
Now, a little bit about NDOA, Northwest Development Officers Corporation.
Association. Sure. Yeah.
It's got to be an A, not a C.
Yeah, NDOA has been around for 30-plus years. It's a we're a professional organization serving the needs of professionals in the nonprofit fundraising sector, primarily by providing extensive networking, training, and education programs throughout the year.
And you've got about 800 members here?
Just about 800 members.
And how has that fared? Is that growing?
That's a good question. It's been remarkably consistent. We definitely there is a cost to be a part of Northwest Development Officers Association. It's $95. We'd soon to go on January 1st up to $110, just because the services we've added over the past 7 years have been almost we added like 30% more services to our offerings to our members. But that's held very, very steady. Small dip last year, but what we're finding is people are very much experienced, know that their networking, just the solace they receive in being with people in the profession, certainly the training and the skills they need are critical, particularly in downtime. So it's a great testament to the work our organization does, and to the health of the field as well. Too, one other thing I wanted to mention about the health of the field is that we have a job bulletin that we put out and keep on our website, ndoa.org. And that job bulletin, as of this time last year, had less than half. So we have 2.5 times the number of jobs listed September of 2010 than we did in September 2009. Just a pretty good sign that there are still our good nonprofits are looking for good people to do the work, and that we need good people, and there's really a critical demand for positions out there.
Okay, did you hear that, listeners? If you're unemployed and you have an interest in getting into the not-for-profit field, they're looking for you. But I would think that because of the unemployment rate being as it is, that maybe you'd have more and more people coming over. By the way, you yourself were a corporate type, or I'm not sure what you were doing, but in any case, you switched over, 4 or 5 years ago?
I switched over about 12 years ago, but I had been an advertising salesperson working for Reader's Digest and Parade magazines in New York City, and just realized that there was more. I had the skill set to do that, but at the end of the day, there was not meaning for me to be doing the work I was doing. And that story is told in many different ways, but a similar undertone by many, many people who come from the for-profit side who are looking for more meaningful work. Maybe they start as volunteers and realize they have a skill set, particularly either as a fundraiser or a director. There's a lot of different roles people do play in the nonprofit, not just certainly the fundraising side, but we provide the service for the program and people deliver the services. So I think there's a lot of people trying to transition over the past 2 years. I don't necessarily think it's a huge bump from prior to the recession. I'd have to let others sort of provide me more measurement statistics, but we are seeing a healthy amount of people transitioning at this time. Maybe they lost their jobs, but maybe that was just the right kick in the pants they needed to say, hey, this is what I've always wanted to do. So we provide a great base source of the education people need to get into the field. There are other higher degree programs people can get, but NDOA is really the first place people turn in the Northwest when they're saying, hey, I want to transition. I'll start to check out and build my network and build my skills in that sector.
And remember, listeners, if you have an interest, a question that you would like to address to Trip Switzer while he's on the microphone right now. Anything having to do with philanthropy or his organization, Conservation International or the NDLA, give us a call in the next 5 minutes at 425-303-9070. Trip, how about a little bit more information on some of these programs that the educational programs that NDOA has?
Sure. I think I mentioned we have, I have to have the list in front of me, but we have, I'm going to say 20 different educational and networking opportunities. And networking is a really big part of our field when people sort of just get to know the community of people in which they're working and potentially hoping to work for. So the two cornerstone events of our year are our winter and spring conferences. The next, we have a winter conference this year on January 28th at the Washington State Convention and Trade Center. And then we have our spring conference on June 10th at the Meydenbauer Center in Bellevue. And those bring together between 300 and 400 professionals. We usually launch the day with an outstanding keynote speaker and then break out into training sessions throughout the day. We have a course offerings throughout the year that are geared for folks just entering the field. Called Fundraising 101. Then we have Fundraising 201 for people 5 to 10 years in the sector. We have another session called Strategic Issue Seminars, which really kind of dig our hands in with a panel discussion about the real meaty issues, particularly one of the issues we're trying to get our hands around is this Gates and Buffett Giving Pledge, if maybe some of your listeners have heard of that. And then we have another session called Access to Experience, but we're really, which is really just as time over coffee in the morning with people with 20 or more years of experience. A lot of rich, robust offerings.
Do we have any idea at this time where that billionaire pledge is going to end up? Where, you know, not only how much money is going to actually be given, but is it going to filter down to the smaller charities?
That's the question I think we're all want to know. And it's really still – the jury's still out and will be out for a while. And I think very few nonprofits have a touch with those in that billionaire society where Bill Gates – and for listeners who don't know, that's Bill Gates and Warren Buffett pledging 50% or more of their wealth and trying to get others in that social economic strata to do the same and sign on to that commitment. And it's been it's really inspiring. But with real inspiration is moving down to people who in our sector, people, and many people have already done that. And that's really, I think, the real difference will be made if people say there's a positive in that, in the sense that many people who make less than Bill Gates and Warren Buffett can do that. They can make a real impact in their local, regional, and national nonprofits. The potential danger is that people might think, wow, that's great. Look at all these, look at the Forbes 400 billionaires making this commitment. I'm off the hook. And that's certainly not what they want to do. And I don't think that'll be that case, but a real reinforcement that there is an impact beyond the Forbes 400, those billionaire societies, that hopefully we'll see. But it will take some time.
And if I have money that I want to give to a charity, and by the way, at our household, we get about 10 to 15 requests per week in the mail easily. I think that's conservative for different charities, and they're pretty much redundant. I don't know how charities can afford to do all the mailers that they do. But if I wanted to check on a charity and find out how efficient it's run, what do I do?
Well, there are great resources available online. They should all be free. And last time I checked, Charity Navigator is what we, for instance, Conservation International has a 4-star rating, 4 of 4 stars on Charity Navigator. You can go to the Better Business Bureau charity. Just go to the Better Business Bureau and search for the charity links.
The major thing that they're rating is how much of the money goes to program.
Exactly. That's the primary rating that people look at. Deficiency, a percent of dollar raise that goes to program, percent that goes to fundraising, for sure. But we still find so many people look at that. But ultimately, I do believe in my heart, people are motivated by their passions and their history and something that's impacted their life is something they care deeply about.
Well, that's great, and I think we're about at the end of this interview, but why don't you, if someone has an interest in either becoming an employee in the not-for-profit field or wants to know more about NDOA or even Conservation International, how can they get in touch?
Sure. They can contact for NDOA. They can search our website, www.ndoa.org, or email our office, which is office at ndoa.org. They can certainly contact me. My information, my email is t.switzer@conservation.org. Happy to respond. t.switzer@conservation.org.
Great. Terrific. And also, let me mention at the end of the interview that KSER is a not-for-profit radio station. And they're going to be starting up a pledge drive here on Friday, which will last for 9 days. And the goal for the for KSER is to raise enough money and approximately 670 members would do it, either new or renewal, so that we can expand local news programming and take care of our indebtedness to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So, if you like the music that you listen to on KSER, or if you even happen to like this program, which has been here for 20 years, almost, or any of the other programming that is on KSER, just remember that you are our lifeblood, and we depend upon your contributions to keep the station going. So, if you can't wait until Friday and you'd like to contribute today, you can go to the webpage at ksr.org and do it that way. Or if you just want to wait until the pledge drive comes up on Friday, that would work out too. Thanks a lot, and now we're going to go to Tony Baruffi, who is the certified financial analyst and portfolio manager at Seattle Northwest Asset Management in Seattle. And Tony's going to bring us up to date on fixed income, otherwise known as bonds. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Chuck. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Oh, we're doing well.
Well, I'm sure things are busy in the bond universe. We were talking earlier about how two of the three topics for discussion here are actually not suffering any sort of recession, gold, obviously, and fixed income. Fixed income being the safe haven for people who don't like the stock market anymore at this time. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. But I'm just wondering, with interest rates remaining as low as they are, and yet access to credit has become much more restricted, what are we supposed to do with that type of scenario?
Well, in this scenario, we're getting a lot of clients, a lot of prospective clients coming to us looking for ways to secure safe income in their retirements, or even if they have savings that they want to keep safe, they want return of principal, not necessarily return on principal. And you're seeing that really across the board. Mutual funds are seeing huge inflows into bond funds. And you know, and on the flip side, you look at small businesses and their access to loans or lack thereof. It's a challenge because banks, investors are seeking safety right now. And if the investment is perceived as safe, the yields are really reflecting that.
If the investment is perceived as safe, they're not getting any more than 3.5%, right?
Yeah, I was just looking at the yields on a 10-year maturity, A-rated corporation, is right around 3.5%. Microsoft, a very strong company that just borrowed money. They don't need the money, but they borrowed it anyway, and they were being lent money at less than 2%, set an all-time record.
And what about in the municipal bond universe?
Municipal bonds, it's a interesting story there, where you see yields continuing to go lower, but many of the municipalities are having some problems. You read about deficits that they're facing, budget shortfalls. There's a real concern there, and not all municipalities are created equal. You really have to, when investing in municipal bonds, look at their financials and be comfortable with them, because you're not being rewarded with a whole lot of yield right now for taking what could be a lot of risk.
Well, and a lot of those municipalities that are having problems are probably the same municipalities where the where you had pretty much a chasm in home prices.
Yes. You know, when their economies were growing at 5-10% a clip, they grew their budgets at the same level or even faster. When the economy has slowed down and the real estate market took a fall, those budgets, it's very difficult for municipalities to reduce their cost structures, and that's just what they have to do. So you're seeing a lot of hard choices being made by municipalities, and some of them are not making those decisions and just kicking the can down the road, as they say, borrowing more money in hopes that they'll be able to repay it one day, and that is a concern.
Yeah, I was just thinking to myself here that I've been bad-mouthing equities, but equities had a really good month of September. I think I heard that...
Well, Chuck, not all investments can be bonds. I mean...
Can be bonds? No, but...
they can't be as great as bonds.
But no, but what I was getting to is they had mentioned that this was the best September for the stock market since 1939, although September's not over yet. So who knows what happens in the next 2 days. But I'm just wondering, do you see anything happening that would be of a major change in the stock and or bond market coming up in the foreseeable future, or is this something that has to play out for another year or two?
Well, you know, in terms of the bond market, the things that the bond market are looking at is they're certainly looking for direction from the Federal Reserve. Chairman Bernanke has come out and said that he sees weakness in the economy. He's very concerned about deflation or disinflation as opposed to inflation. So they're actually looking to ease their monetary policy further by buying treasuries on the open market.
He's still Helicopter Ben, right?
He's still Helicopter Ben.
Throwing money out the helicopter.
Right, right. And, you know, there's a concern that right now we're not seeing inflation. The banks aren't lending, so you're not seeing the growth in money. And but that could change in the future, so there is a concern about that. You know, we have an election coming up, and there's a lot of choices being faced. I mean, here in Washington, we're seeing at least two initiatives to increase taxes to close some of those budget shortfalls. There's a lot of things that could. China and our relationship with China. There's talk more and more of a trade dispute and the U.S. slapping tariffs on Chinese products, which could exacerbate a trade war. You know, things like that could certainly affect the value of the dollar, where interest rates are, and what happens with the stock market.
Yeah, that's something you don't really hear too much about yet, but it seems like the longer that we stay in this kind of quagmire, the more likely we're going to start hearing people to talk about tariffs, et cetera.
Yeah. Let me just
come in here, Tony, to mention at this time that this is KSER Everett, 90.7 FM. In this case, you're listening to Getting Your Dotarize, a financially sound adventure. And I'm talking with Tony Baruffi from Seattle, who is the portfolio manager at Seattle Northwest Management. Tony, since you're managing a portfolio, maybe we could tell a little about the way you've been managing the portfolio, what your feeling is right now. I think you mentioned to me before the show that you've shortened up the maturities for your clients, which means that you're not that optimistic about the immediate future.
Right. When clients come to us, retirees looking for income, we have to kind of go through a process of showing where interest rates are right now, where they've been in the past, and they can certainly return to those levels. And what we're seeing is as interest rates have come down, that a lot of people are starting to reach more and more for yield. And it's almost very similar to what we saw early in the decade, where interest rates were low coming out of the dot-com recession or the recession of 2002, 2003, and people were taking more and more risk, and they got into securities that, banks, pension funds got into securities that they shouldn't, namely bonds backed by subprime mortgages. Now we're getting questions from retirees seeing securities that offer very high yields, 10-12%, but they're very complex securities with a lot of risk in them, and you really need to understand those risks to invest in those securities, because oftentimes you're not getting compensated nearly enough to take on the risk that those securities have.
Well, I guess I'm surprised that these retirees are still looking for a high return, which would normally be associated with a high risk. I'm not sure what layer of the income scale they are, but to my way of thinking, if I were in the top 1% of people with wealth, after seeing what has been going on for the last several years, the crashes in the market, these things that have been going on, such as the flash crash back in March, where several stocks went down 20-30% in the space of minutes, and there was one stock that went to pennies, which was a perfectly good stock, and no one's actually given an explanation for this flash crash. I guess we're going to get one here in the next few days, if I understand CNBC. And then you have this what's called the high frequency trading, and these are all pretty much just terms to me. I'm not that fully knowledgeable about it, but I think a lot of the people that are in the upper 1% probably know a lot more about it. I would think that a lot of those people are saying, "I've had enough of this. I don't want to play around in that market anymore. I'm going to stick with treasuries or whatever and get my minimal return. I don't even care if they can't keep up with inflation, because I've got way too much money, more than what I need anyway. I'll let my beneficiaries figure out what they want to do with it."
Yeah, and one of the things that we're seeing is a lot of people did not have an allocation to bonds, and now they're moving into them. So you read articles about there being a bond bubble, and we're not seeing it. We joke that there'll be a bond bubble when the person taking your groceries out to your car is explaining how he's day trading U.S. Treasuries. I haven't heard that yet. People are investing in bonds because they know they're going to get their money back on a certain date. They're legally obligated to do it.
How come nobody day trades U.S. Treasuries?
Some do, but it's not nearly as widespread as certain other bubbles that we saw. So
yeah, in fact,
there's a ways to go.
The bond trading is huge compared to stock trading, right?
But it's a massive market, yes.
But
and
it's not,
very diverse.
It's not by individuals. It's
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's many different layers of risk. When people talk about a bond bubble, they look at yields that are so low, and if yields rise, people are going to lose a lot of money. Well, that may be true if you own a 30-year or 40-year bond, but if you own a 2-year security, you're going to get that money back in 2 years. If rates rise, you're going to get your money back in 2 years, and you're going to be able to reinvest it at those higher rates. So that gives investors some safety there. You certainly want to pay attention to the credit quality, make sure that they are going to be able to pay you back. But you know, for those reasons, the specified income at certain dates and getting your money back on certain dates is very attractive to retirees, because you're not taking on market risk. Unlike housing or stocks or commodities, where you're dependent on selling that asset to someone to get your money back, and you're taking on the risk that the market price isn't where you bought it, bonds are attractive.
And we should mention in closing here that there are bonds that you can purchase that where the return varies with inflation, treasury protected, inflation protected securities.
Sure.
And are they available besides in TIPS? Are they available outside of treasuries?
Certain corporations issue them. There's not very many. So I would certainly look at the TIPS, or the Treasury Inflation Protection Market is much broader. And right now they're not offering a lot of yields because inflation is low. So you might have a small allocation to it, thinking that if inflation does begin to rise, you can add money to it. Some people say it's cheap protection right now.
Do you use them in your portfolio?
From time to time. Most of our clients right now, because inflation is so low, to protect against inflation, we're actually looking at corporate bonds. Why? Because, A, corporate bonds offer a higher yield, so we're able to take that higher income stream and reinvest it over time. And corporations, their credit quality actually gets better with rising inflation. If you think about an average corporation, their revenues will rise as they're able to charge higher prices. Their debt load stays the same because their debt is not indexed to inflation. So their revenues look better relative to their debt. So it's a nice way of protecting against inflation in this low interest rate environment.
Okay. Well, that will do it for today. And thanks again, Tony, for coming back one more time.
Well, thanks for having me.
And we'll just have to see next time where we're at in terms of whether we get some inflation or some disinflation. And we'll be back with you probably in a few months.
Well, I look forward to it.
Terrific. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you.
Take care. That was Tony Baruffi, who, again, is a chartered financial analyst and portfolio manager at Seattle Northwest Asset Management in Seattle. And now we're going to go to gold, silver, and numismatics with George Marley. And let me put out the phone number for anyone who would like to call and ask George a question about their gold bullion or Krugerrands or whatever it is they have. And that number is 425-303-9070. Even if you have a 1904 Lewis and Clark Exposition gold dollar, give us a call. I mention that because I used to have one of those. Hi, George. How are you?
I'm just fine.
And thanks for waiting. And we've got about 20 minutes to talk about gold and silver and numismatics. And let me put this out first of all. How do you decide when somebody comes in and they have a Krugerrand, or maybe they have gold fillings or whatever? How do you decide how much to give them for that?
What to pay for them? Right. We have basically a established buy-sell spread on the major bullion coins, American Gold Eagle, the Maple Leaf, Krugerrand, things like that. And gold fillings, if it's yellow gold, is 16 carat. We just weigh it up and pay a percentage of what it melts for using the spot figure that's provided. We use two different websites to chart and watch the price of gold and silver and platinum through the day. And then one is amark.com, the other is kitco.com. And kind of watch the two of them, see if there's much variation between the two. And there usually is not. But as a Krugerrand is an example you asked about, excuse me, We buy them at $3 over melt. We sell them for $48 over melt. We have a $45 spread. And the
now, the reason why you actually pay more than it's on the spot is because of...
It's mainly because right now they're worth more to us. The premium over or under changes, and the way it changes is the large... big dealers, guys way beyond my size, that do millions of ounces in a day. If they're long in a particular product, they're going to lower their price and lower their sell. If they're short something, they're going to raise their buy and raise their sell. And we kind of go base our prices on what the big guys do in terms of, because that's where we're going to end up selling any large excesses that we get or purchasing product that doesn't walk in across the counter. So we have to be very aware of what our suppliers, being suppliers of both buying and selling, are doing. And
so, but the spread differential between the buy and the sell is quite small.
Well, I think it is.
Yeah, well,
it's been
compared to other things that you that are
right.
collectibles.
Well, it all depends on the dealer. I've had people actually come in and think that it's something that chiseled in stone and every coin dealer in the world buys and sells at the exact same prices. Well, obviously that does not happen. We try to pay a fair price for coins, bullion. We try to sell it for a fair price and just try to make something in between. It is something we don't make a great deal of money on in terms of percentages, but because of the way the market is right now and the amount of business we're doing, both buying and selling, it all adds up. It's in the same manner that Tripp was talking about, small contributions all add, and you know, as those things add up, we, you know, hopefully make a profit.
Did you say something about actually melting down the...
We don't ourselves. Oh, no. Okay. We sell our scrap, whether it's 14 karat, 18 karat dental gold, whatever it might be, to a larger wholesaler that ultimately does get melted. Yeah.
So does the person that brings that kind of gold in get paid at the counter, or do they have to wait until you?
No. We pay at the counter. Mostly, we pay 98% of our transactions are with cash. Once in a while, somebody asks for a check, we'll give them a check, but mostly it's a cash transaction. It's virtually immediate.
I guess one thing we ought to tell listeners is when you go into the dentist and they remove a tooth that's got a gold in it, make sure you get the tooth.
Absolutely do so. A lot of dentists provide it, give it to the patient anyway. Some don't. Some do if they ask for it. But it's amazing how quickly that little cap or that little... thing adds up, and dental gold's and it plus it's 16 karat, which is higher quality than most of the jewelry out there, which is normally 14 karat.
Is it worthwhile to do that with silver too?
We don't buy a great deal of silver other than bars and stuff. We don't do jewelry.
Yeah, or dental.
No, we don't touch anything in regards to anything that's white that comes out of the mouth was not of interest to us.
Let's see. I should also mention that Ed Bremer, who is the news director here at KSER, went on vacation with his wife Lucia recently to the Black Hills, and they ran into quite a few people, three or four of them, that had actually moved to the Black Hills to become prospectors. So I guess that's my indication that we're in I don't know if I want to call it a bubble, but there's a lot of people that have gotten interested in this.
Well, at the level gold is, yeah, certainly.
Yeah. And, you know, I was waiting for gold to get back to the way I remembered it about, I think it was about 25, 30 years ago when there was just everything was gold, it seemed. Mm-hmm. And I think we're there again.
Well, right now, today, and I'm sure most of your listeners are aware of this, gold has never been higher than it was today in terms of its closing price at over $1,300 an ounce. I mean, a lot of mines have reopened that were, when gold was $300, $400 an ounce, we just weren't producing enough. The ore quality wasn't worthwhile mining. But now the gold's up at these levels. They're reopening old mines, things like that. And there's folks that are doing it just for having something fun to do. Go out in the middle, you know, pan a stream or dink around out there and try and find something. And the people that are actually trying to make a living at it again.
Well, I find it a bit fascinating when I hear about how much gold there is, if I can believe it, because we got 6 billion people on the planet, and then we got 2 Olympic swimming pools full of gold.
Yeah.
If we could fill those pools.
People have no idea how little gold. I've looked it up for somebody perhaps 2-3 years ago, and for me it's the same thing. But it was a cube about 51-52 feet. High width and depth, which doesn't sound like a whole lot. I mean, when somebody asks you how much gold has been mined, you know, they might refer to, Safeco Field or something, say it's full of gold. No, it's nothing even close.
Yeah.
There's not all that much out there. Yeah, it's something that is valued everywhere in the world, just about everywhere in the world. People respect it, have valued it for thousands of years. It's something that is right now extremely popular.
Someone also made the comment that at the rate of inflation, that when gold was, I think, 800 back
about 825,
back
850,
in
yeah,
1980,
mm-hmm,
that if you inflated that price of gold to today, that gold should be at 2300,
something like that. Yeah,
yeah.
It's not in terms of real dollars. No, it's not where it was. That was an artificial market, though. Pushed by Nelson and Bunker Hunt when they tried to corner the silver market, and they got silver up to $48.50 an ounce. And what you're seeing now, we feel, is honest value. I mean, it's a real market. It's not being pushed arbitrarily or artificially by anybody, any countries. We feel the upside is extremely strong. Doesn't mean it's going to continue to go up day after day after day. There might be some correction, but we honestly tell people that come in, 2-3 years from now, 5 years from now, you're going to look back and go, gosh, $1,310 an ounce? Gosh, I wish I would have bought more.
You think?
Oh, I think so.
Okay.
I honestly do. Silver and gold both, yeah.
No bubble in gold.
Oh, I don't want to necessarily say there's no bubble.
Well,
in
we
gold,
don't know what a bubble really is. I'm defining a bubble as a 20% correction. I got chastised last month for mentioning that was the 20% was enough to call it a bubble bursting. Let's call that a mini bubble.
$260 correction would be substantial, obviously.
Yeah, that's right. That's what it would be. $260 correction.
If it is, what a buying
opportunity. Wouldn't even bring it down to $1,000, though.
No, it would not.
Yeah. So it is kind of a mini correction.
Yeah, that would be.
Yeah. But how would that help your business?
We buy and sell when there's action. If it's moving up, if it's moving down, if it's just stagnant, not doing much of anything, there's really not much interest. We're finding many, many, many more people coming in that are interested. We have buyers and sellers both. I mean, there are people that are just adamant that gold, there's no way it's going to get any higher. Now's the time for me to get out. We have people coming in going, I've never had gold before, but I know it's going higher. I need it now. We're there to basically provide a service and try and treat folks fairly and just buy and sell the stuff and suggest ways to go. One thing we obviously tell people is this is not the only thing we want you to buy or that you should have. We aren't expecting anybody to cash in all their bonds and treasuries and sell all their stocks to buy nothing but precious metals. No, but it is something that everybody should have a little of. Whether it's gold, whether it's silver, it just makes sense to put a little bit away as you can afford to do so.
Well, in the last 5 minutes or so, maybe you should mention the problems people have or get themselves into in gold and silver and numismatics, such as I believe there is such a thing as fool's gold or
there's counterfeit coins out there.
Counterfeit gold. What about iron pyrite?
Pyrite, again, you're talking something I don't have much to do with because we do very, very little in nugget form or anything like that. What we do is refine gold, whether it's jewelry or primarily bullion coins, Krugerrands, maple leaves, eagles, all the things that used to be popular, like 50 pesos, 100 coronas, ducats, all that kind of stuff, sovereigns. And we still buy and sell that stuff on a daily basis.
Where do you find the counterfeit gold?
I have seen, in 33 years of doing this, personally, I've seen some bad pandas, China pandas, Chinese pandas that are counterfeit. And a gentleman working for me has seen one bad 50 peso. Other than that, I have never seen a bad gold eagle. I've never seen a bad Krugerrand. And I've handled lots of them.
Well, you'd have to think at this price, you'd probably start seeing more.
It's possible. I mean, there's bad counterfeit, synonymous terms, interchangeable, U.S. gold pieces, such as the old 2.5s and 5s and 10s and 20s that were struck in the early 1900s and late 1800s. There's counterfeits of those out there, certainly. We get offered counterfeits probably every 2 or 3 weeks, normally by people I don't believe that know they are counterfeits. Sometimes you got to wonder, though.
And also, I think a lot of the appreciation in gold has come about as a result of the ETFs that you're not familiar that much with ETFs, but exchange-traded funds, it's become a lot more easily accessible to own gold, quotes, by buying these ETFs.
And you can put gold into IRAs, Eagles, and things like that. And it's no longer something that you're the only kid on your block that has it. More and more people are thinking about it. And if there's anything we can impress your listeners with, is just think about it. You should have something other than paper that indicates you have a store of value. Silver or gold, and do not buy it and store it someplace. Get it in your own little paws. Have it in your own hands. You want access to it.
Well, Tony Baruffi, our previous guest on the telephone, was going to ask you about the best way to secure gold if you've purchased it.
In terms of securing it, putting it in something safe?
Yeah, what do you tell your clients?
You can put it under the mattress. No, I mean, you can put it in a home safe. You can put it in a safety deposit box, although there's some, I don't want to call them extremists, but some people that are a little concerned that might not be the best place to keep them. You can always bury it, which I think is foolish. You just want to have it someplace. You don't want to, if things get really bad really quickly, you don't want something that indicates you have a 10 or 20 Krugerrand sitting in a bank vault in Houston, Texas that does you no good. You want them physically with you. And there's so many different ways of buying gold in terms of the size of the coins, 1 ounce, half ounce, quarters, tenths. Silver is no longer the poor man's gold. It's a metal unto itself that is very, very viable. All of these things, you were talking about percentages earlier. I just for sport, I looked up exactly what gold, silver, and platinum were a year ago today on the 28th of September in 2009. Gold is up 31.7%. Silver's up 34.5%. That's a decent return. Does it mean it'll always happen? No.
I think gold was up 30% the year before that, too. I think
it's
gone up 30% twice.
We've been open a little over 5 years, and gold was $443.90 when we opened, and silver was $703. Both of them are near. Silver's over tripled, and gold is nearly tripled.
One thing somebody should do if they want to either buy or sell gold or silver is to shop quotes.
Shop around.
Right.
Yep. I mean, I'd love to have them come to us, but it just makes sense to check around with several different dealers, see what their prices are, their buybacks. I would suggest strongly looking at local coin shops. There's a lot of good coin shops in this area. From Bellingham to Olympia, there's probably 25 shops, and all those are, for the most part, I think, very good people. And just whoever's selling at the lowest price, it seems to make the most sense to me.
Right. Well, that's my traveling music, so I want to thank you, George, for coming in. That was George Marley, who is the proprietor of the Coin Market LLC in Lynnwood. And previously on the phone was Tony Baruffi, chartered financial analyst and portfolio manager at Seattle Northwest Asset Management. And to start off the show was Tripp Switzer, who is the president of Northwest Development Officers Association and also the senior director of regional development, more easily remembered as fundraiser, for Conservation International. And thank you, Tripp, for joining with us here also.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that should do it for this month's episode of Getting Your Dough to Rise. I just want you to remember that we will be back again the last Tuesday of the month. This time it will be October 26th. When I will return, and I trust you all too, for another episode of Getting Your Dough to Rise.